Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories along with Susan Shand. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the United Nations Children's Fund says Nigeria has the largest number of child brides in Africa. The custom of young girls marrying much older men happens mostly in the Muslim-majority northern states. Girls in the area are usually married by their early teens, whether they want to be or not. Conservative Islamic groups in the area resist efforts to ban child marriage. But times are changing. Hajia Rabi Salisu is the founder of Erida Relief Foundation and owner of a children's home in Kaduna. She says that girls are increasingly running away from child marriages. Salisu and other activists want states to ban marriage before the age of 18. She says she receives death threats because of her activism. She told VOA, "I sleep in a different home almost every night because my life is at stake simply for trying to protect the lives of children." Ramatu Ibrahim and Najatu Abdullahi are both 14 years old. Both girls ran away from their homes so they would not have to get married. They met at Silisu's home for children. Ramatu says, "I was being forced into an arranged marriage. That was why I ran away. I don't love him, and I don't know him. I had never seen him before." Najatu told VOA she wants to get an education.
In another village in Kaduna State, VOA spoke with 18-year-old Sumia Musa. She has resisted the expectations of her community. She said, "My father wanted me to get married when I was 13, but my mother said no, because she was in support of my decision to further my education." She added, "People here in this village laugh at me because I am not yet married." She said that used to make her cry sometimes. But she said, when she thinks about how her education will better her life, she stops crying. Nigerian lawmakers have been debating marriage customs for more than 20 years. The country's 2003 Child Rights Act says that people must be at least 18 years old to marry. But individual states can decide whether to approve the law. Most northern Nigerian states have not. Muslim rights groups have been meeting with northern lawmakers to express their concerns. Some activists propose a law that requires a person to be at least 15 to marry. But that idea offends Awal Taslim Shitu. He is a member of the Muslim Lawyers Association of Nigeria. He argues that a girl's readiness for marriage cannot be decided by her age. He says some 15-year-olds might not be ready for marriage, while some girls as young as 9 might be. He says, in Islam, there is no barrier to that.
In 2013, a social media campaign, Child Not Bride, began to spread in Nigeria after Senator and former Governor Ahmad Sani Yerima was accused of marrying a 13-year-old girl. Yerima denied the accusation, but would not tell his wife's age. Yerima also supported a law that would legally recognize any married female as an adult. In 2014, a 14-year-old girl in Kano admitted to killing her 35-year-old husband with poison. Police said the girl's father had forced her to marry. Later, the murder charges were withdrawn. Rights activists say poverty leads parents to force their young daughters to marry. Activist Mustafa Wakil says they just want to take these girls off their hands as fast as possible. He notes that financially poor parents have been accepting unusually low dowries. Some are as little as $8. Parents used to request at least $112. Wakil is campaigning for his state of Yobe to pass the Federal Child Rights Act. He says the current laws on marriage are not clear. Ramatu and Najatu want to hold on to their childhoods a little longer. They are attending school and hope their families will one day forgive them for running away.
India's $34 billion market for gold is changing. The buying and selling of gold has traditionally been done face-to-face. But now, smartphones, e-wallets, and some investment programs are bringing new buyers into the business. Digital payment systems have grown in popularity in India since the government stopped producing large-value banknotes in 2016. Now there are computer software applications that let smartphone users buy, sell, or keep gold, even in small amounts. The Reuters news agency reports that a private company keeps gold purchased or sold electronically in secured storage vaults. Online gold purchases have been growing worldwide for years, but they are a new idea in India, where jewelry and pieces of gold are often kept by individuals or given as gifts. In India, the action is really starting now. The digitization of the economy will certainly lead to the digitization of gold, said Somasundaram PR. He is managing director of India operations for the World Gold Council. He believes the digitalization of gold will grow in the coming 12 to 24 months. The World Gold Council estimated total Indian gold demand at 727 tons in 2017, and thinks it could rise to 800 tons in 2018. It is difficult to estimate how many buyers are entering the market because of software apps or the internet. One digital payments company reported that in the first 6 months after it began offering digital gold last April, it processed about $18.4 million worth of sales. That represents a small part of the Indian gold market. With most purchases made in the traditional way, demand for physical gold is not slowing. Indian buyers are also interested in competitive pricing and the ability to purchase gold in small amounts. Gold-based offerings, such as gold accumulation plans, let users buy and store gold in amounts as small as 0.1 grams. Many young people like these plans, along with other online investment programs. In the past, everyone who wanted gold had to wait until they had saved a large amount of money to make a purchase. Joe Jacob, a 29-year-old businessman, recently bought 5 rupees worth of digital gold as a trial investment. He said that buying digital gold is easier and safer than having gold physically in his home. Security experts said that because the gold is guaranteed to physically exist in a secured place, there was little risk of dishonest sellers. And digital wallet providers believe interest will grow. I'm Susan Shand.
Scientists have discovered evidence that some of the earliest members of the human race, Homo sapiens, were surprisingly advanced. Scientists say these early humans knew how to use color pigments found in nature, create advanced tools, and trade for supplies with other groups of people. A report on the discovery was published recently in the journal Science. The scientists said they examined artifacts recovered from southern Kenya. Some of the objects are said to date back to 320,000 years ago. They are about the same age as the earliest known Homo sapiens fossils found in other parts of Africa. In the report, the researchers described an ochre pigment that produced a bright red color. They say this pigment could have been used for body painting. They also found tools made from obsidian, a volcanic rock that can have an extremely sharp edge. The researchers found evidence of obsidian being transported to the Olorgesailie Basin, up to 88 kilometers away from where the rock was found. This discovery led the scientists to believe it had come from another group through trade. But they did not know what was provided in exchange for the obsidian. The researchers said the findings show developments in technology and social structures unexpected so early in human history. Rick Potts is a paleoanthropologist and director of the Human Origins Program at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. He believes that these newly identified mental and social abilities, including recognition of distant groups, use of pigments, and technologies including projectile points, were at the foundation of our species' origin. Allison Brooks, another paleoanthropologist, is with the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Speaking of the pigment, she said, "The choice of importing the ochre from a distance rather than using a more common local material argues that having a red face or hair or clothing or weapons also carried a symbolic message of some sort." The researchers described the obsidian tools they found as smaller, of better quality, and more specialized than larger stone tools used by earlier human species. The obsidian was used in a number of tools with sharp or pointy edges. The rock was also found in small, sharp points that could be placed at the end of a piece of wood or bone for use as a weapon.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. President Abraham Lincoln led the Union of Northern States in 4 years of civil war against the Southern Confederacy. But he did not live to see the end of the war. He did not live to see the nation reunited. He was assassinated in April of 1865. Shep O'Neill and Morris Joyce tell what happened after Lincoln died.
Almost immediately, officials began planning details of the president's funeral. They asked Mrs. Lincoln where she wanted her husband buried. At first, she said Chicago. That was where the Lincolns were going to live after they left the White House. Then she said the Capitol building in Washington. A tomb had been built there for America's first president, George Washington, but it had never been used. Finally, she remembered a country cemetery they had visited. At the time, her husband had said, "When I am gone, lay my remains in some quiet place like this." So Mrs. Lincoln decided that the president's final resting place would be in the quiet, beautiful Oak Ridge Cemetery outside their hometown of Springfield, Illinois.
For several days after Lincoln's assassination, his body lay in the East Room of the White House. The room was open to the public all day. Next, the body was taken to the Capitol building. Again, the public could come to say goodbye. Then the body was put on a special train for the trip back to Illinois. 4 years earlier, President-elect Lincoln had traveled by train from Illinois to Washington. He stopped to make speeches in cities along the way. Now, on this sad return trip, the train stopped at those same cities: Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, Cleveland, Indianapolis, Chicago.
In every town, people lined the railroad. They stood silently with tears in their eyes as the train moved slowly past. Farmers working in the fields saw the train and dropped to their knees in prayer. For the wise man who had led the Union through 4 years of bloody civil war, Father Abraham, was dead. Churches throughout the country held memorial services. Ministers told their people that God had taken Lincoln because the president had completed the job God had given him. He had brought peace to the Union and freedom to all men.
The final service was at the cemetery outside Springfield. It ended with the words from Lincoln's second inaugural speech. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in. Let us heal the nation's wounds. Let us do all possible to get and keep a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations.
While the nation mourned Lincoln's death, federal officials investigated his assassination. The man who had shot Lincoln in Ford's Theater was an actor, John Wilkes Booth. He had fled the theater after the murder. The government offered a reward of $100,000 to anyone who captured Booth and his helpers. The investigation produced the names of several people who were friends of Booth. One was John Surratt. Like Booth, he supported the Southern Confederacy during the Civil War. Another was David Harold, a young man who worked in a store in Washington. Others were George Atzerodt, Louis Payne, Sam Arnold, and Michael O'Loughlin. Most of these men had stayed at a house owned by John Surratt's mother, Mary.
One by one, in the days following Lincoln's death, these people were arrested. Anyone else who might have had a part in the plot was seized. Soon, hundreds of suspects were being held in jails in and around Washington. At the end of a week, only two of the plotters were still free, David Harold and John Wilkes Booth. Booth broke his leg when he jumped from the presidential box to the stage at Ford's Theater. A few hours later, he and Harold stopped at the home of a Dr. Samuel Mudd. They reportedly gave the doctor false names. They asked him to fix Booth's broken leg. Dr. Mudd agreed, and he let the two men sleep at his home. Federal troops chasing the assassins arrested the doctor. They accused him of being part of the plot.
John Wilkes Booth and David Harold ran and hid for 6 days. They crossed the Potomac River from Maryland into Virginia. Finally, 12 days after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, soldiers found the two men. They were hiding in a tobacco barn near the town of Port Royal. Harold agreed to surrender. He came out of the barn with his hands in the air. He shouted again and again that he was innocent. Booth refused to come out. The soldiers set fire to the barn.
The fire forced Booth to move close to the door. The soldiers could see him now. He was aiming a gun at them. The soldiers had been ordered to capture Booth alive. But one of them raised his gun and shot Booth in the neck. The actor fell. Some of the soldiers ran to the burning barn and pulled him out. They carried him to a nearby house. He died 2 hours later.
John Wilkes Booth carried a notebook. He wrote in it every day. On the day Lincoln was killed, he wrote, "For 6 months we had worked to kidnap Lincoln, But with the Confederacy being almost lost, something decisive and great must be done. I struck boldly. Booth described how and why he had shot the president. Our country, Booth wrote, owed all her troubles to him, and God simply made me the instrument of his punishment. Booth's body was returned to Washington. Men who knew him confirmed that it was the body of John Wilkes Booth. The body was buried under the stone floor of the Washington prison. A few years later, his family received permission to move the body to a cemetery in the city of Baltimore.
Evidence showed that only a few people were actually involved in the plot against the president. Most had agreed to work with Booth because they believed he planned to kidnap Lincoln, not kill him. Of the hundreds of persons arrested, only 8 were brought to trial. The Secretary of War decided that they would be tried by a military court. He argued that Lincoln had been commander-in-chief of all military forces and had been murdered during wartime.
The trial began almost 2 months after the assassination. The prisoners seemed in poor condition. All wore heavy chains on their arms and legs, and the men had been forced to wear thick cloths over their heads. Officials said the cloths were necessary to prevent them from talking to each other. The Secretary of War announced that the prisoners could not meet privately with their defense lawyers. They could meet only in the courtroom. Guards could hear everything they said. One of the defense lawyers recognized that the job was hopeless. He said the trial was a contest between the defense lawyers and the whole United States. There was no question, he said, what the military court's decision would be.
The government tried to prove that Lincoln's assassination was a Confederate plot. Witnesses told how Confederate supporters reportedly planned to cause trouble in the North. But none could prove that Confederate President Jefferson Davis, or any other Southern leader, played a part in Booth's plot to kill Lincoln. 400 witnesses appeared. Many of the important ones had been arrested as suspects. They agreed to give evidence if the government dropped the charges against them. For 6 weeks, the court heard evidence against the 8 prisoners. The prisoners themselves could say nothing. They could only listen.
In late June 1865, the trial of Abraham Lincoln's assassins ended. The military officers serving as judges met secretly for 2 days. Then they announced their decision. All 8 prisoners were found guilty. One received a prison sentence of 6 years. 3 were sentenced to life in prison. 4 were sentenced to die. Defense lawyers appealed for mercy. The appeal was rejected. On July 7th, David Herold, Louis Payne, George Atzerodt, and Mary Surratt were hanged for the murder of Abraham Lincoln.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.